Welcome to VarmBlog, where our aim is to give you the best in analysis in philosophy, political economy, history, art, culture, and geopolitics from a left-wing and socialist-friendly perspective. We aim to bring you different perspectives from different walks of life and to have you educate yourself what to do with what you learned here. We do not aim to give you prefabricated and easy answers. Abandon all hope, ye who subscribe here, for you will learn, and it will be your responsibility what you do. And with that, let's begin today's episode. I'm here with Dr. Rebecca Carl, who teaches history at New York University, and she's the author of many books on China, the most recent one being Chinese Revolutions in the 20th Century, or The Legacy of Chinese
China's Revolutions in the Modern World.
China's Revolution in the Modern World. I'm conflating your two titles. I first discovered you about a decade ago from Mao and China in the 20th Century Concise History. But you've also written books on Chinese feminism. And I think you have another book on the various narratives and literary retellings of Chinese revolutions. And I think one of the first things that strikes people about your book is that, your most recent book, is that you put a plural on revolutions and advisedly so. Would you like to go into, you know, what are the revolutions of China in the modern time period?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on your podcast, and thanks for delving into all of the books, or at least some of them. I started my career writing about what I had assumed at that time to be the first of the modern revolutions, the revolution of the against the dynastic system in the early 20th century, the one that overthrew the Qing dynasty in 1911 that resulted in what's often called the Republican Revolution. And so my first book is about that revolution. I've come over time, and that was published in 2002. But I've come over time to understand that one has to, in order to properly understand the problem of the modern in China, one has to understand the problem of the multiplicity of revolutions. In other words, that revolutions are multiple. There are many types, and that in order to understand how modern revolutions in the plural are connected not only to each other, but to a global context that gives them also a large significance, one has to push it a little bit further back. And so the book, China's Revolutions in the Modern World, A Brief Interpretive History, which is published by Verso in 2020, tries to think about revolutions both as a revolution in intellectual terms. What does a forced encounter with different modes of thinking require of the those who are experiencing the encounter in serious terms, and then also what are the consequences of the intellectual forced encounter and the forced encounter with a logic of social life and a logic of economic and productive life that is different from the one that one inhabits. And so that pushes me into the relationship between the global capitalism and China in the 19th century. And in some ways, that's a relatively conventional view of, you know, China responding to the problems that were brought to it by the Opium Wars and the Western imperialist powers in the 19th century. But rather than turn to those relatively more conventional and now actually relatively reviled versions of Chinese history, I try to think through from the perspective of the Taiping Revolution from the 1850s onwards. What does it mean that the Taipings were informed not only by a certain weird sense of Confucian propriety, but also by an adoption of certain forms of Christianity. Often enough, because these were peasants and they turned out to be pretty violent in many ways and internally incoherent in many other ways. But so that the often enough the Taipings are considered to be anti-modern or not modern. But what I try to think about is how the encounter with global capitalism and the encounter with Christianity forces them to rethink to rethink the premises of social practice in China, and that's what I'm calling the modern. And therefore, the modern is both Chinese and global, always already from the get-go.
It's interesting when you think about the Taiping Revolution that very few people have considered it a revolution in modern terms. But if you go back and actually even look at like early materials, it was floated as a slur. But when Westerners would sometimes call it, they would call the Taiping the Taiping leaders revolutionaries, and then that has been largely faded out. Why do you think the revolutionary nature of the Taiping insurgency, and I mean, we have to also admit, it's the bloodiest civil war in world history, right? I mean, yes.
Before the Civil War, the American Civil War,
right? Okay,
which overlaps with the end of it, yes.
Okay, so it's either so it's the first or second, depending on how you're thinking about it, the timeline. But why do you think it's been taken out of the recounting of revolutions? Like it's just not considered, other than its anti-modern context. Is there any other reason why you think it's been not seen as part of the Chinese revolutionary tradition?
Well, in part, well, of course, Mao Zedong did see it as part of the revolutionary condition, and Marx also saw it as part of an astonishing uprising from a place that he certainly didn't understand at that time in the 1850s to be revolutionary. But Marx and Mao, I think, misrecognized in their enthusiasm for revolution, they misrecognized the Taiping as well, as being, you know, sort of linearly or directly connected in a certain sort of linear sense to what happens next. And I don't think that that's actually the case. I think that why the Taipings come to be dropped out of a revolutionary context is twofold. One is because they were unsuccessful. They were suppressed. They did not successfully overthrow the Qing dynasty in any of the ways that they had intended to do. And so that lack of success makes it very difficult to think of them as anything but a bunch of failed peasant, atavistic peasants who were aggrieved peasants, as it were. And part of it is because their selective adoption of Christianity, which is, of course, it's sort of a peculiarly anti. I mean, the missionaries and the role of Christianity in Chinese society was profoundly conservative. It was not revolutionary, and so to think of Christianity in its adapted and adopted forms as revolutionary is slightly bucking the trend, as it were, because, you know, revolution is understood to be political. It's understood to be informed by the most advanced theories of the world rather than the most conservative theories of the world and so on. So there are various reasons. It's also because it's just such a peculiar, it's seen as so aberrantly peculiar that I think it just gets dropped out of the equation a lot. But I decided to start my book there because part of what I want to do with the problem of the modern is to think of it as an intellectual problem that is not limited to intellectuals, and as a social, political, and economic problem that has a relationship to lived experiences in China, but also in the world at large.
So one thing I've always had trouble grasping is how important is the Taiping Revolution, Rebellion, et cetera, in, we call it all the things it's called, in the formation of a Chinese nationalism, because while the Han ethnicity was super important to it, I think it was led by Hakka, correct?
That's a matter of some dispute.
Okay, so it's debated. Okay.
Yeah, the presence of a lot of Hakka women, for example, who had natural or unbound feet, was a feature that was often commented upon by horrified Han folks who thought that these women were, you know, were men in disguise or, you know, and so on, because they didn't have small feet. And, you know, and then there's a whole tradition of claiming Hakka leadership for all sorts of things. So I don't get into that mm-hmm. particular ethnic issue, but yeah.
So to expand on that a little bit, the next revolution is the one that I think most people start to think about in terms of revolution, which is the Chinese Nationalist Revolution. One thing that I have tried to when I have taught this revolution to abroad, and what I've tried to wrestle with is the conception of nationalism that they're working with, because a lot of the materials you get in the West kind of talk about it, but in this very vague Chinese nationalism, we're not going to go into details. We're going to let you just project on what you think China is and what Chinese nationalism would be here. Or you get Marxist Leninist writings that portray this as a bourgeois revolution. And one thing that you go to some pains to point out in the book is you don't think that the, you know, hardline vulgar historical materialist, you know, Soviet reading of this as a bourgeois revolution really works with the nationalist revolution. So what do you think is going on there? And what's the notion of nationalism that they're operating with?
Well, I mean, one of the things, and this derives from my reading of the Taiping Revolution and then the intervening 50 years between the Taipings and the Republican Revolution of 1911, what we're calling the Nationalist Revolution of 1911 against the dynasty. One of the through lines that I discuss I hope I've discussed in the book is how the problem of Chineseness gets put into question. In other words, what the category of what and who and how to be Chinese is the modern problem that is posed in through the Taipings, and that in the Republican Revolution of 1911 is, as you know, quote unquote, solved, although of course it never is solved, but is solved by, at least temporarily, by the overthrow of the dynasty. In other words, in order to be modern, China had to have politically a Republican form of government that was perhaps, you know, multi-ethnic, but was led by and through the majority ethnicity, the Han. And of course, the revolutionary movement of the early 20th century was posed in two different ways. One way was fully ethnic exclusionary. In other words, this is an anti-Manchu. The Manchus were the ethnicity that were responsible for the Qing dynasty. And so the overthrow of the dynasty then meant also anti-Manchuism. And so that it, there was a whole faction, the leading faction of the 1911 revolution, Sun Yat-sen and his followers, were explicitly anti-Manchu during the and Han-centric during the lead up to the 1911 revolution. In the immediate aftermath, once the dynasty has fallen, has abdicated and has fallen, and there's a new polity on the horizon, they quickly backtrack from the anti-Manchuism into a multi-ethnic conceptualization of the nation state now. The other form of the revolutionary movement of the early 20th century was less ethnically centered and more centered in what we'd call today modernizationism, or sort of, you know, a form of understanding China now as being backward vis-a-vis the so-called advanced countries and having to build itself into a more modernized economy and polity. And in order to do that, it was said by this other faction of radicals at the time, in order to do that, the dynasty should be retained, but be put under the form of a constitution, sort of British style rather than American style republicanism, or that sort of thing. So, or Japan style constitutional monarchism rather than American style republicanism. Constitutional monarchists lost that fight. But ultimately they joined the Republican government in trying to steer that government into legitimacy and consolidation of its power quite poorly, as it turns out, but they did do that. So what is nationalism at the time? I mean, the way I think of it is that it is undoubtedly revolutionary. In other words, it has affiliation to anti-colonial revolutions around the world. And that's the subject, in fact, of my first book, Staging the World, which draws out the affiliations between the Chinese revolution of that time and the Filipino anti-American, anti-Spanish revolution, the Cuban anti-Spanish, anti-American revolutions, the Turkish revolution, the Egyptian revolution against the Turkish Empire, and India against Britain, and all of the anti-colonial revolutions and revolutionary movements that were then going on. And so I explained the ways in which China's revolutionary movement of the 1911 period, of the pre-1911 period, were affiliated globally with these anti-colonial revolutions in ways that fed an ideological predisposition towards the centering of ethnic nationalism over modernization, even though modernization types of arguments fed into that as well. So they weren't exclusionary, but it was, you know, it's the ethnic nationalism at the time was far more radical, even though, of course, today one hesitates to call anything under ethnic nationalism anything but atavistic and regressive.
To me, when one thinks about struggles of national liberation, that you do have to put, like, to label them from the standpoint of now is always kind of misleading. I often think about that when we talk about, like, what Marxism in general, not just in Asia, but being all over the place on this question because it's hard for them to answer, but also because, like, they, you know, breaking up the old European empires and the world empires was part of their program, and nationalism seemed to be a pretty apt way to do it. Although even in the European context, at least to, like, weird historical aberration, like Wagner and Engels being on the same side. Yeah. Sun Yat-sen is an interesting figure because he's one of the few KMT figures that's maintained as a key figure into the next set of revolutions. Why do you think he was more, I mean, other than being dead by the time this really happens, but why do you think he was more redeemable for the CCP up to their, you know, when they start gathering up for the civil war and their own revolution, as opposed to other KMT figures?
Well, Sun Yat-sen was redeemable for the Communist Party, the CCP, because in part he was not as anti-communist as his successors ended up being. I mean, his successors, mm-hmm. like Chiang Kai-shek and the other leaders of the Nationalist Party, of the Kuomintang, what you're calling the KMT, also called the GMD and Kuomintang. Mm-hmm. There's endless numbers of ways of calling it. But so his successors were pledged their nationalism as unalterably opposed to the communists. Now, part of the reason that Sun didn't do that is, as you mentioned, he died earlier. He died in 1925. Before the nationalist communist split became the central feature of Chinese revolutionary and counter-revolutionary life in political terms. And he lived long enough to see the success of the Russian Revolution in overthrowing Tsarism, and of the success of the Bolsheviks in finally winning the Russian Civil War, suppressing the Mensheviks and the international interventions and so on. And so he was also, you know, a great believer in the then Comintern policy of sponsoring a united front between the communists and the nationalists in order to achieve what by then was a hopelessly achieve a unity out of what was by then a hopelessly fragmented political situation and social situation in China that had broken apart into various warlord satrapies and fiefdoms, as it were. For which there was no central government. And so the Comintern had sent folks into China trying to find people who were amenable to setting up a communist party, for one, but then also to find a way to bridge a gap between communist understandings of the world and the nationalist understandings of the world. And so through the 20s and through until Sun Yat-sen's death, they were able to foment this kind of unity. And this is the kind of national unity that the communists were able to rally behind later on, once they'd won their central position. So Sun Yat-sen was never completely discarded. He has always been understood to be the father of the nation, the Guofu, to be the progenitor of either the, you know, of the Republican Revolution and the great revolutionary who carried that forward. So he's understood to be a revolutionary in the modern way, and to have certain lines of intellectual affiliation to the Communist Party that they can embrace rather than, and that they pose themselves as successors to rather than as opposers of.
So when you go into the categorizations of this revolution, you, like I said earlier, you were somewhat adamant that just calling it clearly a bourgeois revolution is not correct. Can you go into the logic that you go into in the book a little bit there? And can we talk about why this even matters? So,
I mean, ultimately it doesn't matter to me. I mean, but it does matter it when we think about, revolutionariness or what is a revolution. And, you know, folks fight over whether any of the so-called bourgeois revolutions were bourgeois or revolutionary. So, you know, there's that in the out there in the scholarly community. And I didn't want to address that particularly. But what I did want to do is to think about how the modern, while the modern, the problem of modernity and the problem of the modern forces us to think China in the world, because China can't be modern without the world, and the world can't be modern without China. So I think that it forces us in that into that kind of relationality, but it does not force us to put China into a linear stage narrative of that somehow follows some predetermined set of stages that all modern histories are supposedly forced to follow. And so I think that by calling the 1911 revolution a bourgeois revolution forces us to think about it in ways that I think really miss large portions of it. The bourgeois revolutions in the Western world were not anti-colonial. Those were pro-colonial. Those generated colonialisms. China's was on one level anti-colonial and has to be seen that way. It has to be seen as being part of a non-European response to being partially colonized by capitalism and the Western, Western imperialist powers, plus Japan, of course. So I think that the colonial problem, the problem of capitalism being forced by at gunpoint upon China, all of those things require us to think about the Chinese 1911 revolution outside of the sort of so-called normative stages of revolutionary becoming that became, you know, part of a linear narrative of all modern histories. I think that there's just too much. I mean, the fact that in China itself, in the 1920s and 30s, there were huge debates about what stage of revolution or what stage of social life China was in, whether it was feudal, whether it was bourgeois, whether it was capitalist, whether it was this, that, and the next. And those were very consequential debates. Those are hugely consequential for revolutionary theorization, for revolutionary strategy, and for intellectual life itself. So I don't think these are irrelevant considerations, which is why I spend so much time on it in the book. But it's also why I think that forcing China into these categories really forces us to miss or allows us to discount or miss all whole swaths of things that can't be shoehorned into those categories.
One thing that's always fascinated me about the 1911 revolution, that whole consolidation period up to about 1927, is it does seem like like there, even after the nationalists win, that there's a contestation about what it means to be Chinese, even down into the, you know, I don't speak Mandarin, but I do know enough to know that the words for like Han nationalism and Chinese nationalism are not the same words.
Right.
How much, one thing that I've struggled with when we talk about nation states in the modern world is, on one hand, from this time period, you start seeing the narrative of continuity between the dynasties emerging, of which, you know, there's some legitimacy. It's not totally a myth. And yet there's also this push, you know, very quickly. And Sun Yat-sen's Three Principles of the People, one of the first principles is the peoples of China. And he lists five, you know, the Han, the Tibetans, the Mongol. Quote Muslims, yeah, and the Mongols,
Manchus, Muslims, Mongols, Tibetans, and Han, yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. How is that tension between a unified ethno-nationalism, as kind of represented in Han nationalism, and this pluralist civic nationalism? I guess would be the best equation to it in English. How does that tension really play out in the, you know, in the narrative histories of this period? Are there, like, does Han nationalism, you know, kind of resurge after Sun Yat-sen, and how important that, how does that lay in the groundwork too for the next revolution? I guess there's a lot in that question, but.
Yeah. I mean, let me just say this first, is that what you're pointing to, and what is of course an abiding question that I have dealt with for my whole career as a scholar and as an intellectual and as a human being, living in the contemporary world, can be reduced down to the problem of the hyphen between nation and state. Okay. What is it? What is that hyphen? And the idea that that hyphen is constantly the problem rather than the solution. Okay. And I think that's what you were just articulating. And that's also what I have, my first book, really, when I wrote the preface to the Chinese translation of the book, I said, this is a book about a hyphen. And it's a hyphen that doesn't exist in Chinese, but it does exist in English. And it's a hyphen that would properly be put into Chinese as between Minzu, ethnos, Guojia, state. Mm-hmm. And that if Chinese had this kind of punctuation, it would be interesting to put it in there to see what it does to what at several times becomes a naturalization of that relationship. And I think that what the hyphen does for us is that it forces us, if we look at it properly, it forces us to never naturalize that relationship, to always put that relationship under question. And so with that as the premise, what I think is each of these revolutions in a certain light is a re-articulation and a re-adjudication of that hyphen. Okay. And as I said, I think in the pre-1911 period, Sun Yat-sen and his folks were explicitly anti-Manchu. I mean, they explicitly understood the nation and the state to be unhyphenated and one. In the post-1911 period, it became very clear that if they were going to find any kind of unity, they had to get rid of the anti-Manchu sort of rhetoric and move more back into a less ethnicized, more pluralistic form of hyphenation, as it were. But this was always then with the idea that the Han were to be the center of the ethno state. Now this gets adjudicated over and over and over again. I mean, the fact is that during the Republican period, during the 1911 to 1949 period, and even in the period during which the Kuomintang, the nationalists, had were consolidated as the state of China in 1927 and afterwards, they had no capacity to actually dominate the peripheral areas where Mongols, Muslims, Tibetans, and Manchus mostly lived. Okay, they're mostly on the peripheries of central China, in the larger imperial empire territories, but not within the centrality of China. And so their ability to rule over those peoples made the rhetorical inclusion of them not, I mean, consequential in terms of conceptualization, but not so consequential in terms of having to share their power, because there was no power to be shared. It didn't matter, really. I mean, and, you know, there's scholarship that is showing this to be a little bit less clear cut than that, but more or less it's pretty clear cut. By the time you get to the communists in 1949, well, let me back up just one second and say that through the Republican period, this coinciding with the 20s, 30s, and 40s, there are majorly huge discoveries of the oracle bones and of other kinds of sources that seem at like Beijing Man, like relics of the archaeological relics of what was called Beijing Man, and so on, that seem to indicate both a continuity of civilizational presence in the geographical area and an origin of human life that takes you out of Africa and places origins of human life in Asia. And these are embraced by certain hyper-Han nationalists as showing the centrality of Han people to civilization as such, not only Chinese civilization, not only Asian civilization, but civilization, human civilization as such. Now, these are scholarly theories. These are are heavily contested and heavily discussed at the time, but somehow seep into a notion of the deep history of Chineseness. That by the time you get to 1949 and the Communist Revolution, you have this is a substratum for sure. But the communists are not interested in claiming that version of deep history. Mm-hmm. They're interested in claiming a different version of deep history, a version of deep history that is a version of constant, always revolutionary uprisings that fall short of overthrowing dynasties and ushering in new eras of communism because there is no communist party. Now there's a communist party. Now the deep substratum of Chinese revolutionary fervor that has been boiling on and on and on for thousands of years, now it finally has the proper spokesperson and the proper organizational form to prevail. And so the communist deep stratum is not the culturalist, deep stratum that is tied to oracle bones or Peking Man relics. It's tied to a materialist practice of peasant rebellion and so on. Both of these forms, let me just say, are equally implausible because neither of them leads linearly to today, mm-hmm. but they are fundamentally different versions of history. But the communists understand this version of peasant rebellion and revolutionary history from the perspective, not of ethnicity. It doesn't matter if you're Tibetan, anti-feudal Tibetan, or anti-feudal Muslim, or anti-feudal Han. If you're anti-feudal, you're one of us, right? So for the communists, it's the ethnic issue is an issue of governance, for sure. They have to bring these peoples into a centralized state and a consolidated centralized state, but it's not an issue of defining their nationalism.
Right. So this is a good place to transition to 49 and the communist revolution. And I mean, whenever I talk about this, I always foreground this as like, you know, Kuomintang consolidation of the country of the national government happens in 27, and then almost immediately you have a low key civil war. So like, and then the, you know, Japanese invasion, etc. So it's not like nothing is happening between, you know, for 25 years. It's just easy KMT rule, but there are many, many reconceptualizations that you point out in your book that really happened with this revolution. But I think one of the things that people will be interested in as we go forward is you don't really consider the first communist revolution to be the only communist revolution in China in the 20th century. But let's talk about what shifts, I mean, other than the obvious economic one, with the Chinese Communist Revolution, because I think you point out two things that a lot of people have talked about, is that the Chinese Communist Revolution not only is different from the classical Marxist conceptualization of what a Marxist revolution is, but it actually is also different and perhaps underexploredly different than the Bolshevik Revolution as well, mm-hmm. in the way it understands its relationship to the capitalist global whole and all these like communist historiographic questions, essentially. So what makes this revolution unique to China? And then his next question is going to be, how does this build off of the prior nationalist revolution? So let's start first with the uniqueness question.
Well, Chinese revolution is unique because it happens in China in a particular yeah, time fair. And place, right? So, you know, but that doesn't make it, as I always tell my students, that doesn't make it uniquely unique. I mean, everything is unique to a time and place, but that doesn't mean that it can't be talked about in the same breath as many other things, okay? Mm-hmm. So the Chinese Revolution, obviously, the form of communism in China, the form of Marxism in China, obviously had to be adapted to and read through a Chinese historical situation. That's what often is called the sinification or the sanification of Marxism. I hate that formulation, however, because it pretends like there's a Marxism out there that's the standard against which the Chinese one then measures or doesn't measure up. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's true. I think that what happens is that Marxism comes into China in the 20s, 30s, and 40s as a way of understanding China, and China becomes a way to understand Marxism. There's a dialectic there that's inescapable, and you can't call that sinification or Marxification of China. You just call it Marxism in China, or, you know, I would call it Marxism in China. Now, part of what that is that China is a semi-colonial or almost completely colonized country when the Japanese are trying to occupy it. And therefore, the Soviet form of Marxism cannot be the correct form for China. It's also true that the Chinese, the way in which Mao Zedong and his faction of the Chinese Communist Party understood the task in China was that the peasants had to take part of the lead in the revolution. Now, in the Soviet form, the peasants were only ever junior allies, and if even that, to the urban-based revolutionary movement. In China, because of the particular way in which after 1927, and the split between the communists and the nationalists, the particular way in which that forced the Chinese Communist Party into the hinterlands, into the peasant hinterlands, and out of the urban areas as a centrally organized form. The Chinese Communist Revolution had to find its new power and its new footing and its new organizational dynamism within the peasant movements and within a peasant mobilization. Oops, sorry, that's my phone. And so the point is that the Chinese Revolution rooted itself in a peasant rural situation that meant that the Chinese Communist Revolution had to reorient their theory around a peasant-centered notion of history. We know that Marxism spoke to industrialization, urbanization, the rise of cities, and so on. And in China, it's not that urbanization, industrialization, rise of cities hadn't happened. It's just that that's not where the communists were, and so they had to think this in a different way, which is essentially what they did. So that the Chinese Communist Revolution was in fact built along along the mobilization of the peasantry, and through the mobilized momentum that the peasantry gave them, and that makes it entirely different from what happened with the Soviets. I mean, it's true, of course, that the Chinese Communist Party, by the time they took the civil war against the nationalists, had a very powerful army that had been tempered in the battles against the Japanese, and that had grown and been fortified through the years of fending off nationalist and then Japanese and then nationalist power. So these are the form of guerrilla warfare that the Chinese communists were forced to use because they didn't have good weaponry. They didn't have great positional warfare capacities, meant that they had built bases within villages amongst people. They had embedded themselves in the countryside in ways that the nationalists never had. So that by the time it came to building a new country, a new power, the communists were there and the nationalists were ousted. So that gives the communists, a certain kind of purchase in the beginnings of their regime after 49 that is very, very unique. I mean, and that's why Maoism traveled so very quickly around to other non-Western colonized, rural dominated countries, is because it spoke to those conditions in ways that the Soviet Bolshevik Revolution did not.
Yes, I'm always interested in that, and yet the tension also between this development and the way it comes out of the Soviets, because other decolonial powers, look at the Congress Party in India, for example, were often admiring of China, but also in direct competition with them. So they were pivoting through the Soviet Union all the time. I think most famously sort of the Zhou Enlai, Jawaharlal Nehru tensions that, emerge at the kind of post-colonial conference in, I think,
Bandung.
Yeah. 1955. And where India thinks it's really going to lead that, and it doesn't end up, it ends up being China primarily who comes out, the more senior partner. And reinforced by Chinese development later. But at the time, if you were going to, like, if you were looking at who was more, say, economically stable or had a firmer grip on power, you probably would have picked the Indian leadership. So, I mean, that's not covered in your book, but it's something that I've always been interested me about the Chinese Revolution, because they were somewhat organically able to speak to these movements in Africa and to some degree in Latin America, very clearly in ways that other forms of communism kind of did, but never as successfully. And
well, the Indian Congress Party was never communist and was never Marxist, right. And to the extent that the Chinese from 49, at least until 76, were adamantly anti-capitalist in their domestic and international relations, they could speak to radical anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, anti-colonial radical movements that were informed by the same set of anti-capitalist theories. I think the Indian Congress had a wholly different version of economics, mm-hmm. and reached out to lean towards the Soviet Union for diplomatic reasons, not necessarily economic or ideological ones.
Nehru did say was a Fabian socialist, but they didn't rule that way. So, I think though this gets. One of the interesting things about your book, actually, the chapters I'm most fascinated with are these interlude chapters in this book in particular. And you talk – the interlude chapters to me, to go into vulgar Marxist speak for a second, are where the dialectical tensions show up. I think the tension that you raise is the kind of – the question of pluralism – and one thing we haven't mentioned is, like, so we talk about with Sun Yat-sen, we talk about like five Chinese peoples. By the time that the Chinese government, the Communist Party is in charge, that number expands dramatically. 52 or 56 recognized ethnicities. Like, it's a lot. Yeah. The Tibetan invasion is kind of a it's a sore point in Chinese history, because it's not something that seems to be, like, in one hand, I mean, Tibet was ruled by a Buddhocratic, semi-feudal, almost monastic state, which of course would be totally anathema to the communists. On the other hand, the incorporation of Tibetan peoples, even those sympathetic to the overthrow of the Lamaocracy, for lack of a better term, didn't go so well. And what do you think this illustrates about the incompleteness or the tensions or the things that are emerging in that time period between 49 and 59?
Well, I mean, this then goes back to the question of what is nationalism, because if for the Chinese Communists, nationalism was never really an ethnic issue, it was a territorial one. And mm-hmm. so the understanding of Tibet as being part of the territorial homeland of what is called China, which is, of course, we know, a heavily contested issue. I mean, the Tibetans have documents that say that they were never part of, the imperial China or the imperial dynastic dispensations. The dynastic documents say that Tibet always was. You can read all of those documents differently and so on. So there's nothing, going to the documents doesn't actually solve mm-hmm. any of the problems. But what we do see here now is the understanding of a multi-ethnic nation whose territorial boundaries must be secured. And so that the nation state, the hyphen becomes part of a territorial understanding rather than an ethnic understanding, where nation and state now are linked through their what is called territorial integrity, and a discourse of sovereignty, and so on. I mean, we have to understand that India was being the Himalayan parts and so on of of Tibet and so on were being used by the CIA and other kinds of infiltrating factions to try to destabilize China in one way or the next. I mean, it's all part of a Cold War, anti-communist, this, that, and the next. And so the idea that Tibet was somehow independent or could be allowed to break away became a problem of territoriality that was inadmissible. And so the invasion of Tibet is part of this larger, Chinese argument about the integrity of the Chinese nation state that derives from some reading of dynastic, boundaries. But we know that the dynasties and the pluralism of dynasties are not known for their impermeable boundaries, but for the permeability of their boundaries. The reason that dynasties lasted so long is because they were flexible about their boundaries, right? They were flexible about things, whereas nation states tend to be very fixed in their national boundary, their territorial claims. And so this was a way to, I mean, so that the invasion of Tibet was really about the establishment of a territoriality to the Chinese national state that was rigid and that included territories that were obviously quite contested. So it did not go well. They were able to incorporate Tibet in an uneasy fashion into the territory of the national state in a way that ever since has been more or less accepted by the international diplomatic community. Even despite the various supports for Tibetan independence. But the international diplomatic community has tended to accept as an established fact that Tibet is part of China, for better or worse. I mean, obviously for worse for the Tibetans.
One of the things about this that I think that's so interesting, though, is there have been other ethnic groups for which this had been kind of an issue, that it did turn out better, partly by adopting civic or territorial nationalism within the nation. So I think about like the old parts of the Joseon dynasty that are now like the Korean ethnic prefecture in eastern China, that they did not have the same issues incorporating, despite the fact that, Korean nationalism has a very ambivalent relationship to, Chinese imperial states historically, et cetera. It does seem one of the things I think your interlude kind of hints at, though, is what makes this impossible later. And I mean, it really makes it impossible, like when Tibetan leaders actually start to famously, I think it's in the late 90s when the Dalai Lama's like, fine, just, make us an autonomous zone, like, these other ethnic autonomous zones that are within China. And China says no. And I think, I think the role of the Cold War politics probably plays into why that happened, even though now it probably has a completely different register.
It might be useful to see these now in versions of as internal settler colonialisms. Mm. I know that there are folks now who want to and who are trying to think through either the Xinjiang question the Uyghur the Han occupation of Uyghur territories, or the push of Han people into Tibet, and so on, in a frame of settler colonialism. I think that there are ways of thinking it that way that might get at some of the tensions between what had been, even in the post 1959 period, had been a form of ethnic policy or ethnicity policy of the Han-dominated government in Beijing that allowed a certain form of language and cultural autonomy to the named ethnicities, the 52 or 56 versions of them who had been affirmed by the state to be actual ethnicities or actual, you know, minorities, as it was called. And so you have the biggies like the Xinjiang, the Uyghurs. You have the Tibetans. You have the Mongols, the Mongolians, and so on, who have large swaths of homeland territories that then get occupied for economic development and for Han resettlement in various ways through the high tide of the Maoist period, but then in like hugely different and more intrusive ways in the post-Mao period. And so it might be useful to see these as settler colonialisms now, internal settler colonialisms now. Dispossession of indigenous lands, dispossession of indigenous resources, reorientation of these around different kinds of logics and so on. I don't think that explains the 59 invasion, however, because I don't think that the invasion in 59 or the suppression of various Uyghur uprisings through those periods were about settler colonialism or about moving Han people in to exploit resources necessarily, even though that also did happen. I think the logic changes in the 1990s towards one of non-autonomy, of integration into national developmentalist policies that are about the extraction of resources for national development in ways that are slightly different probably from the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
So if people have been counting, this brings us to our fourth revolutionary period. And you do see the Cultural Revolution as an independent revolution, even though it's led by some, and that needs to be emphasized, of the same parties within the Communist Party, some of the same groups. One of the things that I think is, I have recently reassessed my own view of the Cultural Revolution because I realized how informed I was by American and South Korean readings of it that were not particularly fair. But you go into the, you know, what really is at stake here in this, and also the Cultural Revolution does involve an entire re-narrating of not just immediate Chinese history, but almost like Chinese history going back as long as we have dynasties in the geographical region we now call China, in a way that I think you get overstated later because Mao is still trying to frame this as in a historically limited materialist way. So we can't say that, like, you know, for example, as might be said now, China is a series of bureaucratic dynasties that, you know, have a certain character. But that does seem to be part of what this is aimed at, because the immediate struggle is against bureaucracy developing within the Communist Party, which Mao sees as a potential road to capitalism.
He's not wrong.
I was about to say, and
he wasn't wrong.
History may have slightly vindicated him on that, given his successors. The other thing though is this also starts the anti-Confucian nature of this in particular is a contested territory during the Cultural Revolution itself. But I do think people don't know how radical it is. I've recently talked to Dong Fu Han on this as well, and I've been reading several books on it about how radical, particularly in the countryside, the shift was, and how, in a way that's hard to explain because it was both top down led and in a not particularly democratic national party, really was radically democratic at the local levels in ways that had not been seen priorly. So can you talk about what was at stake in the Cultural Revolution and why did it involve this re-narrating of Chinese history?
Yeah, well, the re-narration of Chinese history is a through line that I have all the way in from that is also characteristic of each and every revolution, because each revolution, as you correctly point out, the Cultural Revolution being one of them, or the apotheosis, perhaps, of all of them, is the attempt to reattach a different past to a present read differently. Okay, so that you have the present is not a known product of the past, and you have to think about what the relationship of that past to the present actually is, and this creates all sorts of problems and all sorts of issues. And so for scholars and for regular folks. But so at the intellectual or ideological level, what's at stake in the Cultural Revolution is how do you think the Chinese past in the terms of a struggle between economic and social classes that can speak to the radicalized present of the Cultural Revolution, the 1960s and 70s, in ways that are both faithful to the past, but also deliver certain kinds of lessons about the past that are usable for the present. And that ultimately turns out to be quite difficult, because how do you narrate feudalism in the terms of Marxism, for which feudalism does not work? I mean, you have mismatches there between categories. And so then what happens is that you have huge impositions of categories from the present onto the past that don't really work, but that do yield all sorts of interesting kinds of insights, not only into the past, but really into the present. So that's a whole ideological and intellectual thing that many historians, playwrights, cultural producers, and so on found intriguing, but seriously difficult to try to square that circle. And given that the Cultural Revolution was deeply cultural, I mean, we have to take seriously the cultural aspects of the Cultural Revolution, that it was meant precisely to shake free the authority of the past over our present, so as to allow us in the present to fashion a future that was no longer anchored so deeply in the relations and the dominations of the past. I mean, that was its whole point. So that's why the past became such a battleground, is you had to understand it and then wrench free of it. You had to get away from that past in a way that could inform a radically revolutionary present and a radically revolutionarily reimagined future, okay? Because if the future can only be a product of the past, then you're stuck. And so you have to reimagine that past. So the cultural aspect of this was fundamentally important. The political aspect of it then was linked to the cultural aspect of it, because it became clear that bureaucracy was not merely a legacy of China's past. It was a product of the socialist system itself. And it was the product of the Communist Party itself. which meant that if the Communist Party itself was producing bureaucracies that were constraining the ability of the Chinese people to radically reimagine a future, then the bureaucracy itself, which meant the Communist Party itself, had to be smashed. And so that the stakes in the Cultural Revolution were cultural in terms of the rethinking of a past and wrenching oneself out of a constraining by the past. But then they were also revolutionary insofar as bureaucracy is the deadening of revolution, is the routinization of procedure that is the antithesis to revolutionary transformation. And so the fact that the Communist Party was actually the progenitor of non-revolutionary social forms then became the contradictory aspect of the Communist Party, the leader of the Communist Party, Mao Zedong, launching a revolution against the Communist Party of which he was the leader. So it becomes, in that sense, both coherent and incoherent at the same time.
Yeah, I mean that's the fascinating thing about this time period is, in some ways, the central part of the party, the core. I mean, Zhou Enlai, Mao. I mean, people like Lin Bao and all kinds of actually intrigue during this period, kind of becomes more heavy over society. But the other side that I've really discovered in the past 5 or 6 years of studying this is they meant what they said about radically getting rid of it, democratizing the countryside, empowering regular people to autonomous rule, really, really breaking down not just the pre-communist class system, but any class system that may have developed since the communist period, and also kind of finally getting rid of the kind of quasi caste system that had developed in the 50s about class origins. All that gets erased kind of during this time period, and particularly in the countryside. I mean, the changes are kind of dramatic and even show up in like a spike in life expectancy, which if you were to hear only the predominant narrative I heard in the 90s about this, you'd have been totally surprised by.
Yeah, there was real revolutionizing of social life so that forms like the barefoot doctors who were minimally trained or practically not at all trained, educated people who were, sent out with a few pamphlets about, what to do about this, that, or the next, and so on. I mean, some of them were trained, some of them were minimally trained, at least in medical procedures, but they were sent out in order to take care of and provide medical care to people who had never had access to it. And so that the wiping out of certain kinds of infections, certain kinds of diseases that were amenable to cure, but people had never had any access to cures. So that this does raise life expectancy hugely through this period. I mean, there is no doubt that there are huge, and not only among urban folks who have access, who had always had access to better healthcare, but to in the rural areas. It's also true that because intellectuals and educated youths were forced out of the cities in order to learn from the peasants and to go and to, in an effort to democratize learning, to democratize privilege and so on, that schooling in the countryside became far more prevalent and far more accessible, not only to boys who were sent to schools, but very, very essentially to girls who had always had less access to schools than had the boys in their family, since the girls were understood to be wasted mouths. In other words, mouths to feed, because they would be married out into a different family. And so, there were huge ways in which the arrival of educated youth, as very, very difficult as it was on those educated people themselves, obviously, they go down to these villages that they had never even known existed. And, you know, they were and so on. So they, you know, it was difficult. It was very difficult. And they saw it after the fact as a disruption of their natural right to urban life and their natural right to privilege. And that, you know, how could you disrupt our privilege by forcing us into peasant villages? But in any case, the arrival of peasant villages, the animation of educational opportunity, the establishment of what was called people's science, you know, so applied sciences rather than merely abstract science, where, you know, people's energy needs for electricity were solved through biogas experiments and so on, that were, you know, partnerships between peasants who knew their own land and their own resources and scientists who had practical solutions to things. You know, these sorts of things really did revolutionize life in the countryside. Ideologically, intellectually, and practically, materially. I mean, they really did. Which is not to say that there weren't real problems. There were, but these were I think that the problematic aspects of this that are narrated from a retrospective view of interrupted, lost generation, interrupted privilege, and so on and so forth. I think that we have to think about these as real initiatives to revolutionize life. In places where revolution still needed to happen. Yeah.
I mean, it to me, it's one of the few times where a Marxist or communist aligned government has actually tried to abolish town and country distinctions as said in the Communist Manifesto. No one else has really tried to do it.
Yes.
Well, I guess Pearl Pot kind of did by killing them all. But other than that,
not to be recommended. Yes.
Yeah. Bad idea. So I mean, that, you have this radical period of like local democracy. You have, I mean, you can look, I mean, the thing is, even Western stats spell this out. Like it's pretty clear. You see marked increases of life expectancy, but we are narrated this from either the urban or the elite point of view. And there also seems to be a real sense in which maybe the central part of the Communist Party was a little bit afraid of how radical this could get in the cities too. I mean, we do have to think about what happened with the second Shanghai Commune. This comes to kind of an abrupt end, and like I think I have started pushing back on the Deng Xiaoping everything got better in China for everybody model in the last 5 or 6 years, because I started looking at the stats and going, and objectively, no, it didn't. Life expectancy slowed way, way, way down very quickly. It doesn't pick back up until like 1996, like, and stuff like that. And I'm like, I'm not even using CPC documents for this. I'm just looking at the stats that I could look up from the FBI. So it's an interesting, I mean, the Gini coefficient goes wild. I mean, like you go up to like, I think at one point it's like almost 50. During this time period, you know, it's, it has in the last 4 or 5 years gone down to, 39-ish, but that's still higher. I sometimes say it's like, oh, they're catching up to Western Europe, but I'm like, that's still only like 1 or 2 points off of the United States, which is one of the most unequal societies that ever existed on the face of the earth. So, I think these problems are real, and you get into this in an interlude, and then we'll get to the last revolution, which I guess maybe we can, I guess we have to talk about whether it succeeded or failed. But, you know, you don't call it this, but I kind of always think about 79 as a counter-revolution of the old school Stalinists. But this also leads to a reassessing of Mao and both not just in the West, which is always trying to figure out how it feels about Mao because of China's particular geopolitical relationships and how sometimes they're on our side and against the Soviets and sometimes they're not. But also in China itself. So what kind of interpretive traditions about this time period immediately emerge as it ends in the early 80s?
Well, yet again, I mean, one could call it a counter-revolution, of course. I think that it's I don't call it a counter-revolution because I think the stakes in so doing are a little bit muddied. But I think that, again, what happens is a rereading of the past. I mean, you have to reread the past in order to attach it differently to a present and a reimagined future that is no longer the future that had been imagined 5 years ago. So the future as imagined from 1979 is not the future that was imagined from 1969 or from 19 or even from 1974, 1975. So you have to, you know, rethink that past in ways that are persuasive, but that don't actually throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, because Deng Xiaoping's the legitimacy of the one party rule of the Communist Party, after all, still has to rest on the Maoist revolutionary success and the Maoist and 1949. So, yeah, you have this, you know, peculiar document in 1981 that was, you know, written and rewritten and rewritten about certain resolutions on certain problems in the history of our, you know, Communist Party. And it's got a very, very long title. And it's this document that really tries to think about what the disruption of the discontinuity that is Deng Xiaoping's era, how they're going to narrate that as an actual continuity with the past. And it's a very, very, again, a very peculiar document that, you know, only partially succeeds in ideologically papering over what is obviously an ideologically humongous, you know, split. But meanwhile, yeah, Deng Xiaoping's the party that he leads from 78 onwards proceeds to purge the party of Maoists to redo a large number of policies so as to re-establish the primacy of modernity happening in the cities, modernization being urban led, modernization being led by a bureaucratized party that is led by technocrats and educated people, the leadership of elites over the manual labor of the peasantry. You know, so everybody is sort of slotted back into their proper places, as it were. I mean, if the Cultural Revolution was about scrambling all the places and making everybody occupy places that were sociologically unaccustomed, as it were, where elites are down in the countryside and peasants are up in the cities, and you know, you've got a whole scrambling of place. And the attempts through the 80s and 90s are to put everybody back into place, okay, in a normative fashion that follows a certain kind of linear modernization process that is no longer about revolutionary overturning of social hierarchy, but is about the accumulation of wealth and power.
Right.
And this is an entirely different kind of endeavor, and it marks an enormous, yeah, you could say a counter-revolutionary break from the revolutions, or it's a whole other revolution. It's a whole revolutionary, you know, bid that is, of course, not Marxist, but modernizationist. And no, it is not spread equally, or it does not benefit people equally. The Gini coefficient goes berserk, and really, I very much doubt whether the 0.39, 0.4 is real now. I mean, I think that the inequities in China, that wealthy people in China now have been hiding their wealth very, very assiduously. And so I'm not sure that the Gini coefficient has gone down at all. But
even if it has, I mean, you're still looking at a society that has a higher inequity than Western Europe. I mean, like.
Well, and in a very much shorter period of time than any. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing about China, is that everything happened in such an compressed time period that. Whatever what it has yielded has been an incredibly undemocratic, yes, highly unequal, and fully environmentally disastrous new social form that is. Hard to square with where we started,
you know? Right. Well, I mean, to draw out some specifics so people could really understand this, because this is what I was shocked by. Because I had always heard, oh, well, everybody got richer in China after 1979, and you just had some people become super rich. And I was like, when I actually looked at the stats, no, the countryside got precipitously poorer.
Yes.
Female education dropped off to almost non-existent in the countryside, where it was almost ubiquitous just before. Healthcare goes really wild and down. I mean, because they basically privatize healthcare. This is something that I'm always like, you do realize that after the Deng Xiaoping thing, that like China has a less socialized medical sector than South Korea, right? Like it's people don't seem to get this. And I was like, this happens like in 2 years. Like, it's very quick.
The communes that had been the basic structure of social and economic and political life in the countryside had been, responsible for not only production, but reproduction. So education, medical care, housing, child care, so on and so forth. Okay, so that once you break apart the communes and you return the unit of economic and reproductive of production and reproduction back to the household, you have the enormous impoverishment of households. And, if they have to be responsible for everything on their own through their own endeavors, certain households that are nice, are well positioned, are able to capitalize on the decommunization and the breaking apart of commune and privatization of communal property, and the rest of the families are not able to benefit at all from this. In fact, they are disadvantaged by it. And as always, the female members of families find the burden harder, find the disadvantages more stringent, and have to deal with it in more elemental ways. Because many people say this is the happy result of all of this is the withdrawal of the state from everyday life. Well, that's just not true, because at the same time as the economic and reproductive unit of society is returned to the household in the rural areas, the one-child policy takes off, and the state is reaching into women's wombs in a way that they had never happened before. I mean, man, if you're talking about interference of the state, women's bodies are become a battleground of phenomenal proportions. And for all of the reasons that the one child policy is on one level a rational policy, because of the runaway demographic growth would have been disastrous, there's no doubt. But by the same token, to say that this is the retreat of the state is to absolutely not understand what the gendered nature of state intervention looks like. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that happens that gets swept under the rug for the purposes of modernization that are very, very difficult to square with how people actually experienced the transformation from the logic of Maoism to the logic of Dengism.
So this leads us to the final revolutionary period of your book, and I think this is the revolutionary period other than the Taiping that's going to that people will be interested in you included, which was Tiananmen Square. Now, when I talked to Dr. Dumping Han about this, he told me that, you know, Tiananmen Square was basically a peasants' revolt with also...
A peasants' revolt?
Yeah,
it had nothing to do with the peasants.
I know. But I was going to go into that. Then he told me about, you know, the students in the city. And when I was reading your book, I was like, yeah, this seems like it is something that is emerging out of this one party state. I do think it's hard to read under our notions of left and right, because when I've read them interviewed in separate books and whatnot, are kind of all over the place about the society they actually want. You know, but what they kind of all agree with is this modernization period is really coming at a really high cost, right? So how in your book, how do you describe the Tiananmen Square, and how is it a revolution, even if it's not ultimately successful?
If we think about some baseline notions of revolution as being rereading a past against a present so as to imagine a future differently, the Tiananmen Square does that, although, as you say, very, very incoherently, it turns out. And in the aftermath, I mean, some of the student leaders, those who had been the leaders on Tiananmen Square of student formations there, people like Chai Ling and so on, they have problematic politics. But they do emerge. I mean, in 1989, this has absolutely nothing to do with the peasantry. I mean, not that the peasantry, had they known about it, maybe the peasantry would have joined in, but maybe not. But no, this was an absolutely urban-based movement about the ways in which the Dengist reforms of the economy and of society were failing to answer to the requirements of students for the kinds of freedoms that they wanted from state intervention. And so in that sense, it's really not particularly Marxist at all. In fact, one can't read it in classic Marxist revolutionary or counter-revolutionary terms, which is why I think that those terms have to be, you know, thought through differently. But I think it is revolutionary insofar as it poses a challenge to the state to think about what the relationship between economics and politics is actually going to look like. And what the state had been trying to do was to detach economics from politics. And what the students are absolutely insisting is that economics and politics have to be thought together. The upshot is after 1992, after the lull that happens to suppress and to reorient the whole movement, several people have called the depoliticization of Chinese society. In other words, the detachment of economics from politics, where the political was going to be the realm of the state and the economics was going to be the realm of production and accumulation. And obviously the two are linked very, very, very intimately in China, but the pretense and the ideological pretense was that as long as you just accumulate individually, leave the politics to us, the state and the party, and you don't have to worry about politics. And so this is the last hurrah, as it were, of the intertwining of politics with economics. And by 1992, that has failed very specifically.
Yeah. So again, I guess like the Taiping, it's not just that it, you know, it doesn't really fit the Marxist classifications. It also didn't really succeed. But you know, it in some ways it's also like the Taiping. It's not hard. It's hard to conceptualize what the demands were other than democracy, quote unquote. What that means, I'm guessing, probably meant a thousand different things to the people involved. I mean.
The Taipings are one thing. The Taipings were not after democracy. They weren't after any of those.
Right,
they were after was a redistribution of land away from landlords, a different form of productive relations, and so on, all of which led people like Mao and Marx to call them peasant Marxists or peasant rebellions of in a Marxist vein. They had nothing to do with Marxism. My point is that that's not how we have to place them. The Tiananmen folks are not the Taipings. They're really not completely different. That at all. They're about, on one level, securing their own privilege as urban elites. Mm-hmm. Which is why they really don't link up very well with the workers on the square, because there's a whole worker proletarian aspect to the Tiananmen uprisings and the Tiananmen movement that is quite separate from the students. And the students, and it is far more radical than the students, because they're actually looking for a certain kind of democratizing of productive relations within the factories. And the students don't really want to have very much to do with that at all. That's not what the students are interested in. The students are interested in the ways in which politics and economics impinge on their own life prospects, and the ways in which those life prospects have to be rethought within the context of party domination over their lives. And so they're trying to democratize on a certain level the effects of party dictates within their own lives. They're not talking about social democracy in any, you know, in any large sense. I mean, some of them might have been doing so, but really, the upshot of the Tiananmen and is only really understandable if one understands that what comes out of the Tiananmen folks, out of the Tiananmen movement, is the birth and strengthening of what we now understand to be the oligarchy of the hugely allied capitalist classes with the Communist Party. I mean, that's who comes out of this strengthened.
And I think that leads to the interlude, and then maybe some things that don't come up in your book because of where it ends. Because we have the beginning. You know, most people in the West, I think, have only become familiar with the Uyghur situation in the last 3 or 4 years. I've known about it for longer, but actually because I encountered a whole lot of Uyghur workers when I was in Egypt. Which was an interesting kind of predicament. But it really starts to bubble up in 2009. And I don't think at the time it was seized upon by the Western press very much at all. So why do you end the book there? And why do you use it as kind of an example of what you say is the anti-revolutionary spirit of like the post 92 China? So what is that interlude doing in, you know, as a capstone? And then I'm going to ask a few more questions going beyond that.
Well, I have to end somewhere. And the book, the book, the pandemic hadn't hit yet. So we weren't in pandemic world yet. And so, the book was published in January 2020, which means that I finished writing it 6 months before that. So, anybody who publishes books, that's actually a very short lag time between finishing the manuscript and having it published. But Verso works quickly in that regard. So I had to end it somewhere, and I figured I would end it on the on the problem of if the dispossession of Xinjiang, of the people in Xinjiang, of the Uyghurs, and if the mass incarceration of an ethnicity in the name of a global terrorist threat that is invoked, evoked, and you know, used as a legitimizing tool to suppress a whole people, if that's the outcome of the Chinese Communist passage, then we have to the Chinese Communist Party is not the future of radical politics. It can't be thought that. And that's in part, as you intimate, and as you correctly surmise, is a shot across the bow for those who continue to believe that Chinese communism is actually communism. And that the Chinese Communist Party is actually pursuing some sort of radical alternative to American imperialist or, you know, Western imperialist pursuits. And I just don't think, I mean, I'm no supporter of American imperialism, obviously, nor of Western capitalism more generally, obviously. But I do not see that being anti-American means that you have to, or anti-American imperialism means that you have to be pro-Chinese. So I chose to end there as an indication that this is not the future that those of us who are radicals, those of us who are politically looking for ways out of the impasses of our contemporary world, we can't seek that in China right now. That's not where it is. And the situation of the Uyghurs is dire in any circumstance and is unacceptable in every way possible, but it also has to be accepted as delegitimizing the Chinese Communist Party as having anything to say about radical politics today at all.
How do I phrase this? It is interesting to me that that increasingly you will see people make appeals to China as a center of future radical and future communist mm-hmm. organization in ways that I didn't even see like 6 or 7 years ago. No. And I've been trying to wrap my head around this actually for a long time. And your book helps me a little bit. Although the enigma of Xi Jinping remains, because I know anti-Dengist Chinese people who love him, and I know Dengist Chinese people who love him, and I can't square that circle personally, what I know about China. But the Uyghur situation is something that we have to take very seriously. I don't know that the way that it has been, in my opinion, cynically glommed onto in the news helps. In fact, I think it might actually make the situation worse. But it is a real situation. I mean, like, I've been trying to point out the best interpretation of what's going on in the Western provinces is something like a residential school system. And that's the best interpretation that you can do.
I don't think that covers what it is at all. I mean, I think that this is, I mean, I don't think there's anything redeemable about this in the least. I mean, really not at all. I think that there is plenty of evidence for how the mass incarcerations are tied to the ethnicization, the criminalization of an ethnicity and of a belief system, and of the ways in which they are being their labor is being expropriated, their reproductive capacities are being suppressed, their cultural forms, languages, thinking, and so on are being you know, at the attempt to reprogram all of that. I mean, I don't think there's anything redeemable about this at all, and I just don't see. I don't know what press you're talking about. I mean, I think that obviously this cynical embracing of anti-China rhetoric by right-wing senators who pretend to believe to be friends of Uyghurs is a bunch of bullshit. I mean, that's just posturing, you know, idiocy. And I don't think, I mean, it's the same problem that, you know, Tibetan independence had to make bedfellows, or did make bedfellows, with the worst of the cold warrior, you know, right wing mm-hmm. Of the Republican parties, the Strom Thurmans of the world, and so on. I mean, I always kept a really, really arm's length distance from Tibetan independence because of the political bedfellows it fell in with. In the Cold War anti-communist sweepstakes. Now, the way in which Xinjiang is playing into similar kinds of binaries, where, you know, communist China is bad, therefore Uyghurs are good, even though we're anti-terrorist and everybody who's a Muslim is a terrorist, but Uyghurs somehow aren't, but only when they're in China, they're not. And, you know, so the squaring of the circles, I agree that muddies the waters terribly. It makes it very, very difficult. By the same token, I think that the more we can get, the more information there is about what China is doing in Xinjiang, and the more incontrovertible information we have about what China is doing in Xinjiang, the better. I don't see a downside to that. I'm not into, you know, China bashing, obviously. I think that China bashing is just a really easy, ignorant solution to all sorts of very complex questions that doesn't fly. I mean, I think it's just a total non-starter, and it has deleterious effects in, you know, anti-Asian American, you know, violence and so on and so forth. I mean, all of those things are true. And so I think that, you know, there's real dangers, but just because there are those dangers doesn't mean that we have to stay silent in the face of, like, a real, you know, I don't use the word Holocaust, because I think that's, again, you know, has problematic associations, but a real, you know, a very dire situation.
I when I said residential schools, I want to be clear. I'm making an analogy to what happened to Indigenous in the States and in Canada,
right?
Which is what this looks like to me.
Right.
I hope that actually people who understand what I mean by that understands the seriousness of what that actually is. But it does underlie something I think is a theme at the end of your book. And maybe this leads us to the post 09 period. There is a substantive change in the nature of nationalism in China. And I realized it. I've spent a fair amount of time in China, but I've never lived there, and I don't speak Mandarin. But I do know, I've taught a lot of Chinese students who I will admit have a totally elite bias, because if I'm teaching them, they have money where I was at. But I do know that the way that the national question is being framed feels different than what I've, you know, you hear about in the 60s, 70s, etc. And it does feel a lot more like these nation building projects in Europe and in the settled colonial areas, where you are ostensibly open to multinationalism, you know, or multi-ethnicism, but ultimately you kind of have to melt into the dominant nationality. And that seems to be kind of what's going on right now. I think about I think about even hearing narratives from Chinese expatriates about like the necessity for of Confucianism for communism to be possible in China, and some of these people calling themselves Maoist, and I'm thinking about the Cultural Revolution and going, yeah, I don't understand. I mean,
there's the what we would call the raison d'état, the reasons of state right now seem to be to warrant any reading whatsoever of anything, so long as it feeds the centrality and the power of the state. Everything goes, whether that's so-called Maoism, so-called Confucianism, so-called multi-ethnicism, so-called mono-ethnicism, everything now, as long as it is about the strengthening of the Chinese state. And so the state center, I mean, part of the reason I wrote the book about modern revolutions is to decenter the Chinese state. Mm-hmm. Now, what we end up with, as you're pointing out, is the recentering of the Chinese state. And I wish fervently that wasn't the case. But I think I end my book not on 2009, but in 2019 with the JASIC strike, with the Wuhan uprisings, and so on, with the attempts to reanimate certain forms of class alliances, that have to be reanimated if a revolutionary future or a radical future or any kind of future that is not state-centered is to be envisioned. And so I end the book with an attempt to think about what are now still very, very sporadic and very repressed and suppressed moments of possible futures, possible movements that are not state-centered. And so I want to preserve the capacity to think of non-state-centered versions of our contemporary world, and whether that's, Shanghai denizens screaming out their windows that they want to, be free from lockdown, or whether that's, whatever that could be. I mean, is that a revolutionary movement? Of course not. They want to go back and accumulate capital, so they want to be able to consume. They also want to be able to live. I want to think about, I don't think that these, are going to shake the foundations of the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, I'm not constantly looking at the next movement that's going to, bring Chinese communism to its knees. That's a pursuit of pundits who, all they want to do is to prove that the United States is correct and the Chinese are wrong. That's not my version of the world, but so I want to think about these things all the while thinking of the ways in which the narrative power of the Chinese state and the narrative power of intellectuals who are at least in good part allied with the Chinese state is trying to suck the air out of alternatives and trying to regather everything into this narrative of the rise of China and the rise of the Chinese state. And so, yeah, you're right. The flavor of nationalism today is really very different from what it had been. And it is far scarier, far more totalizing in its desires or pretensions, and perhaps even, far more persuasive, although I don't know that to be true. I have not been back to China since 2019 now, summer of 2019. And so what the pandemic era has done to ordinary Chinese thinking, what the current lockdowns, what the current problems are doing, I don't know. I can't speculate on that. I have my access to this stuff is as episodic as anybody else's. So, and you know, I read Mandarin, I read Chinese, so I speak Mandarin. I can talk to people and so on to the extent that anybody's willing to talk any longer, but people are afraid now. People are the communications now are really quite delimited. And, you know, what I used to have were freewheeling WeChat conversations with friends and so on in various places in China. And I don't do that any longer. I don't, you know, and they don't do it any longer either. So, yeah, I don't want to exaggerate the ways in which people are perhaps living in China under the current regime, because people have always found ways of living their lives in and saying what they want to say in those contexts. But I don't know what's going on there now. I haven't been there for a while.
The conclusion of your book about 2019 actually does kind of lead me to the current moment, because for a few minutes at the end of the Hu Jintao period, like, things may actually go a different way. You had this increasing number of basically illegal wildcat strikes that have been going on in China now for really amping up for about a decade and a half. And then you had the figure of Bo Xilai, who, while not a non-state figure in any capacity, did look like there was actually a dissident voice on the provincial level in Shandong. Obviously,
Sichuan,
yeah. Ah, I got to get my provinces right. But what we see after that is a total consolidation in Xi Jinping in a way that I don't think people, like, it's become even harder for me. Like, I used to be able to tell you kind of from talking to people who spoke Chinese and whatnot what the factions were in government. Now I have no idea, really. I mean, I know certain individuals in government will advocate certain things, and some of them greatly concern me. The fact that there is now a Chinese version of the Clash of Civilizations that is also into Carl Schmitt is not something that I would be greatly comforted by. And that is a faction now, particularly tied up into the military. But I can't tell you any of that anymore. It has become, while our access to the internet and stuff has made understanding Chinese China easier, it's also made it a lot harder. I also feel like this is the time where I have the least idea of what's going on, including when I talk to Chinese people in the West who will tell me wildly variant things. I've talked to Kai Zagua, I've talked to some people who still have pretty deep ties into China. And it does seem like, on one hand, from what I can tell, Xi Jinping does seem legitimately popular. On the other hand, I don't know if that's representative of anything other elite opinion, because I don't have access to non-elite opinion anymore. So,
I don't either. I've never been a fan. I've never been somebody who has been able to do the sort of Politburo watching, the tea leaf reading, and so on. I've never gotten deeply involved in the factions of the Chinese state and so on. I mean, what's quite clear is that what Xi Jinping did almost immediately upon ascension to power in 2013 was to try to curb what had been a hallmark of the Hu Jintao era, which was the decentralization of power to the provinces. And of course, the provinces then took that and ran. And what he needed to do was to bring that back into centralized, to bring that back into a centralized power structure. What I think I see now, what happened in Wuhan in 2020, with 2019, 2020, with the outbreak of the pandemic, what I see is happening in Shanghai right now, and so on, is a genuine, I think, local struggle for to wrest power away from the central government. The Chinese, what I think I see in Shanghai, for example, or what I did think I saw early on before the lockdown became a reality, was that the Shanghai government did not want a lockdown. They wanted to pursue the outbreak of cases in an entirely to move away from zero COVID and to move into a different kind of way of handling the whole situation. This was unacceptable, and they got shut down. And the central government moved in their own resources in order to shut down the Shanghai local government. So I think there are still, I think it's dangerous to see the Xi Jinping era as ushering in a totalizing state domination that is all about the centralized state monolithically able to dictate its policies over the length and breadth of the nation. I think that's really, really, really dangerously wrong. But in what ways, I can't tell you. I think there are real ways in which the localities and local governments for whom economic performance and economic issues were devolved down to the localities, and the ways in which they seize those forms as ways of enhancing their own say over their own lives and their own localities. I think that's still a struggle that happens. I mean, it's not unlike what happens in the United States between states' rights and the federal government, but, obviously in an entirely different historical mode and contemporary situation. But the struggle over local power versus centralized power is a longstanding issue in China. And I think that Xi Jinping tried to solve it in a way that has not been entirely successful. Even though what gets talked about in the Western press is often as if Xi, rules in a monolithically, totalizing way over China. And is able to dictate all from a position of all-seeing surveillance and power. I think that's wrong. I don't know if it's wrong in what he wishes to be his ambition, but I think it's wrong in describing what's actually happening. But I can't tell you exactly what is actually happening, because as you say, you talk to 10 people and you get 10 different stories. So
I mean, even 10 people who speak Chinese and have lived there most of their lives.
It's not a question of speaking the language. It's really a question. I mean, it is, you do have to speak the language to get any form of real insight, but that's not the question. The question is, 10 people from 10 different perspectives will have 10 different things to say.
What I think right now is I think the Western press has become more and more interested in China and kind of even worse at covering it than it has historically, which doesn't help. And by that, I mean, like, there's more people looking at it, but they do look at it totally from a state centric point of view without really acknowledging the divisions of China. And then, something like the Uyghurs will come up and people will bring it up, but they like if I ask people what it means to be Chinese versus what it means to be Han in the United States, unless they're from China, they're probably going to look at me like I'm insane. Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't even occur to them that there's a distinction there. And I can't tell if that's what parts of Chinese, and I'm for those who are listening to this, since this is an audio format, I did finger quotes, society wants, because it's a hard projection. But I do know, that relative elite opinion is hard for me to figure out, because factions that seem to hate each other will all And I mean this by ideological factions. I mean factions in the government. I'm also like my understanding of Politburo stuff comes from other people. Will all tell me they all have a reading on G that I, well, frankly, they can't all be right. Like, so it does seem like all narratives have somehow been kind of subsumed to a state logic. Because factions that seem are ideological groupings, let's not say factions, that's probably not helpful, who seem directly opposed to each other, like people who are really pro-cultural revolution will say nice things about Xi and like almost spit when you mention Deng Xiaoping. And then I know a whole lot of Dengists who like him too. And I'm like, well, what's going on? And it's very hard to tell. And it does seem like there is an attempt to consolidate the Chinese state, which is also why I think some of these these subnational questions have become a lot more intense, you know, and I think that's implied by the last two chapters of your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the consolidation of national statism at the top is makes the ethnic and other kinds of issues more acute. And so on. I'm not, you know, I think that most Chinese people, most Han Chinese people would think that Zhongguo Ren, Chinese, refers by definition to Han people and that everybody else is, you know, and then you say, well, what about Tibetans? They say, oh yeah, they're Chinese too, but they mean Chinese then in the territorial citizen sense, not in the ethnic sense. Mm-hmm. I think the vast majority of Han Chinese don't think about ethnicity. They just don't think about it. It doesn't impress upon them. The way in which, you know, the vast majority of white people in this country don't think about their whiteness until they're forced to think about it, in which case they find it very unpleasant to think about it, you know, if they're not attuned to the way in which whiteness produces privilege. So the most Han people do not think in terms of ethnicity. That's just not their terms of. They do think in terms of national state borders, national state power, and in terms of China versus the world, or really China versus the West, but even more specifically, China versus the United States. This has become an overriding, this has become an overriding issue. And to the extent that Xi Jinping is able to project Chinese state power to the world, to the West, and to the United States, and is able to go toe-to-toe with all of those entities in the ways that people desire, then he's seen favorably.
I guess this leads me to my last question, and this is not in your book at all, but it is emerging in my mind as we talk about this. In what ways, I think about a lot of now, I'm now thinking about like how like anti-German sentiment is crucial to consolidating Germany, because Germany is a very disparate set of cultures. It just happened to speak vaguely related languages that are consolidated in 19th century. In what ways does anti-Chinese sentiment, when it is expressed not as criticisms of the government, but as a criticism of China, qua China, whatever vague essence of which we are assuming it has, and also this view of the policies of the central, you know, the Politburo representing the will of China, quote unquote, how much is that actually helping this consolidation? Because it does seem like that whole mutual, like we have two others and we're trying to, like in the United States as well, increasingly anti-Chinese rhetoric is used this way too, is used as a national consolidation project. When you also look around, and I think here in this way, China is very different, but in the United States, I totally agree with you. White people don't think of, you know, like us, even those of us who have questionable whiteness because of some ethnic minority, but we don't think about it much, except in the clash of which we do when our whiteness becomes provisional, or when we have to face other ethnicities and the privileges we so get. I think, however, in the United States, that's kind of undeniable now just because demographic changes in a way that's not, that's nothing, you know, you can't say that about China right now. It's not like the Han are like the same thing as European descended people in the United States, as far as like the birth rates go, at least not now. But there is a sense in which like having an other to which you can consign total agency, and that the agency of a central state represents the agency of a people. And I think every person in the United States would, it becomes clear that it does. And I think it may be even clear internationally, but that people try to use that as a state consolidation thing. So I do wonder, and I don't say this as excuse anything that's going on in China right now, but I do wonder how the framing of these criticisms of what's going on in China as anti-Chinese actually helps this national consolidation project.
Well, of course. I mean, the Chinese have been, as a race, they have been treated as subordinate to white people for, you know, 200 years now or longer. You know, the history of exclusion from the United States is very clear. The history of racial subordination in Australia and Europe, in Africa, and all sorts of places. I mean, all of those things now come into play as Xi Jinping proclaims that the Chinese people are now strong, that being Chinese is not to be is not part of a subordinated race, and so on. So, of course, these are all, you know, and that to the extent that, you know, the pandemic, there were all sorts of racist tropes and accusations that circulated very widely in the United States, in Australia, and in white Europe, and so on. You know, all the Western Europe, and so on, about the derivation of the pandemic, about the Chinese origins, you know, so on and so forth, in order to denigrate the Chinese. All of these are part of a narrative that fuels certain kinds of nationalisms in our countries, and certainly fuels nationalism in China. Obviously, there are, you know, the whole history of China being subordinated to Western capitalism, to European and American and Japanese capitalism, has now been, you know, that era is now at an end, and it's at an end in a very proud way for Chinese, who have, you know, learned in their not wrongly in their textbooks that China was the butt of, you know, of jokes and racist abuse for a very long time. So sure, it's part of it. It's a big part of it. And, you know, which is why the dynamic of, you know, anti-Chineseness, which then yields a dynamic of anti-American or anti-white or anti-Western or whatever it is, however one thinks about it, in China, is a very dangerous dynamic. And it's one that I certainly won't play. I mean, I don't play that game. I don't play that, you know, because I don't support American imperialism, therefore I support Chinese statism, because the Chinese, poor Chinese who need my support. They don't need my support. They don't need my fictionalizing about them. They need, just as the American state needs, a critical perspective on what they do as a state. And what they do as a state is not pretty. Just like the American state, what the American state does is not pretty, and cannot be supported. So, yeah, all of this stuff feeds each other. There is if we have access to anti-China stuff, you better believe they have access to anti-American stuff.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point to end on. That's actually one of the spirits of when I was reading your books, Why I Wanted You On, because I have taken a very, like, we must try to understand and respect Chinese culture. Ultimately, if we're going to deal with climate change, these quote Western culture, whatever that is, and Chinese culture, whatever that is, both have to be said with a big asterisk, because there are a lot of different things, a lot of different people have to cooperate. And at the same token, I have seen a lot of apologia for the state. I mean, I think what broke me was the Uyghur question, when I was like, you are literally, and I had leftists literally telling me things that I'm like, that's identical to war on terror rhetoric that we rejected 15 years ago, but we're just accepting it verbatim when it's from someone else. And I understand there's complicated geopolitical logic here. I understand that people are abusing this, but that doesn't mean it isn't happening. Like, we don't live in a world where just because jerks are taking advantage of something means that something didn't happen or isn't happening. And maybe we have to be very advised in the, like, the words we use about what is happening, and try not to trigger all kinds of inflammatory historical associations. But, you know, it does, I have seen, even when I was living, when I was living in South Korea and visiting China, what seemed like a Han nationalism that was very different than what I read about or known priorly. And I use Han nationalism kind of advisedly there. Like, and I do think we have to be aware of that and go, you know, I don't think just because I don't think just because a nationalism isn't ours that it's good. And I also, you know, I don't think an ahistorical view of nationalism that was always retrograde and always bad, no matter when it happened, because I don't think that's true either. But
yeah, I mean, to go back to where we started, there was a moment in which nationalism was one of the most progressive moment political movements and social and ethnic movements in the world. And then there's a moment when that is no longer true. And we are certainly in that moment. But yeah. Anyway, we've been talking for a very long time now, so
Thank you for your time. People should check out your books, and I will have them linked in the show notes. Is there anything else you'd like to plug or anything on your way out?
Nope. I think you're correct in the very last thing you said, which is there are many global issues that are not, can't break down according to national policies and national needs. They need global solutions, the environment, war, peace, you know, all of the biggies. And to the extent that we are able to solve any of that, or at least address any of that, we have to get, we have to put some national stuff to the side and move on. But I don't see that happening anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, me neither. All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for supporting Varmblog. If you would like more, you can find our stream on YouTube under my name, C. Derek Varm. You can also find us on Patreon, where you can subscribe for early audio access, additional shows, unexpurged audios, Q&As with me on video, and other perks, such as access to our archives, etc. There are 3 levels of support. 1 level even gets you on Patreon shows. Occasionally here you will hear shows done with other creators. I hope you enjoy them. We'd like to thank our producer, Paul Channel Strip, and Bitter Lake and Jason Miles for making our intro and exit music. And thank you for all you do. If you can't support us financially, you can support us by leaving a review on iTunes or your pod catcher of choice. Have a great evening.